these hyperbolic honeycombs and self-similar quasicrystals. And I'm going to be doing a mixture of, I'm going to try to keep it here. I would have loved to have given a chalk talk, but I can't draw most of the pictures here in real time. Or if I did, it would take a very, very long time. And I know this is a subject which maybe there's not a lot of background on either hyperbolic honeycombs or self-similar quasicrystals, and I'm going to need both. So lots of the talk will be kind of background for folks. So yeah,
in progress.
We'll just try to do our best here. So yeah, this is the basic breakdown. Is I'm going to do some introduction, some motivation, blah blah blah, kind of go through some basic history. I'd really love for people to at least come away from the talk knowing both about hyperbolic lattices. That part's actually pretty easy, but quasicrystals as well. It appears touch tones are enabled. Okay, it's gone. Okay, so I'm going to start with that. I'm going to give some background on that. And then I want to describe a story where I combine both hyperbolic lattices and quasicrystals, hyperbolic lattices in two dimensions and quasicrystals in one dimension. And then I'm going to talk about some higher dimensional versions of this story. And I mean, hopefully this part of the talk is self-explanatory. And so as I mentioned, the things I would hope people would come away with is at minimum an understanding of hyperbolic lattices and quasicrystals, and then understand how this kind of story I'm going to describe gives new quasi-periodic patterns that are very sort of intrinsic to this description I'm going to give and are not familiar from standard flat space stuff. And then I'm also going to talk about speculative applications to physics and also some real applications to physics. Okay, so to get started, these stories are very old, right? So Sumerians were using patterns, just patterns and tessellations, all the way back in 4000 BC, right? They were tessellating things like walls with clay tiles and things of that nature. In ancient Greece, for example, Plato had a theory where he discussed tessellating space, so he wanted to tessellate space with sort of polyhedra. Depending on what kind of physics you subscribe to in modern times, maybe things haven't really advanced very far since Plato. So Plato asks, for example, what shapes must a unit have to fill space without gaps by figures congruent to that unit? This is also a practical problem, right? I mean, again, in the case of the Sumerians, you know, you want to tile your walls, or if you're more worried about 3D things, if you're a bricklayer, you know that parallelepipeds can obviously tile 3D space, okay? In fact, Aristotle claimed to have an answer to this question in the case of regular polytopes, so regular polytopes like the cube, the tetrahedron, the octahedron, the icosahedron, and the dodecahedron, the Platonic solids. He claimed that both the cube could do it, as well as the tetrahedron, and that actually turns out to be wrong. Turns out you can only do it with cubes, regular polyhedra, of course. You can only do it with cubes, and for, I think, something like 2,000 years, people were very confused about why nobody could figure out how to do it with tetrahedron. And they just assumed they were wrong and Aristotle was right. But yeah, that turns out to be incorrect. So anyway, you study problems like this and you'll eventually be led to a slightly simpler problem. You'll be led to study what people call point groups. So point groups are discrete groups of isometries of Euclidean space. It just fix one point, right? So you're basically talking about all the sort of discrete rotational symmetries you can have. To say it in modern language, right, you're looking for discrete subgroups of OD. Okay. And so if we just focus on 2D, there's infinitely many, right? You can have Zn symmetry around a point, or if you're also going to allow flips, you can have dihedral symmetry. Okay? So easy peasy. Great. But then what it turns out is that, you might want more than just the point groups. We also want to consider things which actually tile the plane, so you're going to have to toss in some translational symmetry. And so when you toss in translational symmetry, there's this theorem called the crystallographic restriction theorem. It basically describes the effect of adding in discrete translations to the admissible point groups. So again, we had an infinite number here. You can have n-fold rotational symmetry about any one point. But when you add in translational symmetry, it turns out that the discrete translational symmetry, it actually breaks down to only having 2, 3, 4, or 6-fold symmetry around a point in 2D or 3D. Okay, so this infinitely many Zn or D2n point groups just collapse down into 17 so-called wallpaper groups in 2D. Okay, great. So this picture over here is neither from Sumeria or ancient Greece. This is a picture of a museum in Spain. I looked it up. This is a rhombi trihexagonal tiling in a museum in Spain. And I matched it up with one of the wallpaper groups, and it's what people would call in that literature the P6M. Go figure. I didn't explain the naming convention, so maybe that's not very meaningful. Okay, so I want to give just a short proof of why there's no fivefold symmetry in 2D or 3D. Okay, so it's a geometric proof, so it goes as follows. First, what we'll do is we'll pick a site of fivefold symmetry. I've marked it with this little black dot there. Okay, and then we take our favorite nearby lattice site. It doesn't have to be one lattice unit away, just our favorite nearby lattice site. I marked it maybe here in red, okay? And then what we can do is we can hit it with our fivefold symmetry action that we claim that we have, okay? And we'll generate a regular pentagon in some fixed plane. Okay, easy peasy. So that generates this regular pentagon. And then because it's a lattice, it's supposed to be a lattice, all the displacement vectors must also be in the lattice, right? So what I can do is I can go to some other point. So let me grab this here. I'll do it here. I'm going to start adding the vectors up, tail to tip. And I'm going to do it in a different order. So if I do it, I should grab this guy next. I left his head behind. And then finally, add it up like this. And so what we do is these points should also all be in the lattice. So I'll draw them like this. And we see that what we've done is we formed a pentagon, which is even smaller. Okay? And so I can just repeat this argument ad infinitum, and basically you can see that you can make successively smaller pentagons so that it basically densely fills the plane, and that would not be a proper lattice. Okay, so there's a nice geometric proof. Okay, so maybe we're kind of emboldened by this, and we want to try out some other things. So we can try other surfaces. So for example, you can check out the sphere. So the sphere, or Euclidean de Sitter space, or whatever you want to call it to be fancy, right? Or you can try hyperbolic space, or some Euclidean anti-de Sitter space, or other maximally symmetric spaces. Those might be, well, there's only three. But you know, that might be a good place to start. And so, you know, here is a soccer ball. I am told that the soccer ball is the truncated icosahedron. And you see it's made from tessellating with pentagons and hexagons, okay? But sphere tilings are not super duper interesting because they're basically just related to the existence of polyhedra in 3D, right? You make some polytope in 3D, and then you just blow it out to the sphere, and then you're done, right? So for us as Euclidean people, it's not super exciting. Okay, hyperbolic space, on the other hand, is maybe a little bit more spicy, so it's definitely harder for us to intuit. Okay, and hyperbolic space itself is interesting, right? Applications in art, we'll see some later, biology, network theory, just anything that sort of grows exponentially larger as you go out to the boundary, there might be some sort of hyperbolic-y description going on, right? And the reason why it's generally harder to describe is because in hyperbolic space, there's sort of more room. Right? It's the same thing I just said, which is vaguely that, you know, a ball in hyperbolic space, the volume of it sort of grows exponentially with the radius, rather than like, you know, r to the d. Okay? So in physics, these sort of things also show up. So there's some things like hyperbolic band theory. So people in condensed matter settings will describe, like, you know, what happens to Bloch's theorem in hyperbolic space. There's things like tensor networks. So formerly Giffre was here at Perimeter, and you know, he would talk about things like Mira or something like that. And there's error correction. So there's error correcting codes like the Happy code, which takes place on what we will later learn is called a 5-4 lattice in hyperbolic space. If you were at recent talks by Joanna Erdmanger or people in her group, you'll see that there's some attempts at doing some sort of thing like discrete holography. So people will take regular lattices in hyperbolic space, and then they'll try to see if they can, you know, recover things like the BF bound or something if you put a scalar on the lattice or something. Okay, so there's things like that. Here's a really cool example I like, which you can actually do in a real lab. So this is called circuit QED. And so what these things are, this is an actual picture, is these are coplanar superconducting waveguides, and then you can shoot microwave photons down them, and you can engineer these little circuits out of these waveguides. And when you do that, you can basically simulate having, well, if you engineer a system like this out of it, you're basically engineering having this sort of lattice here in hyperbolic space. So you can pretend you can do QED, strongly interacting QED or weakly interacting QED in hyperbolic space, and you can actually do actual experiments like this. Okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
In which sense it's hyperbolic? It's more looks like it's just a standard magic on a disk.
Yeah. So the way it's hyperbolic in this picture is that in hyperbolic space, right? even though it looks like you're just on a disk, right? You know that like going just a teeny smidge out near the boundary of the disk should be like going a long distance in hyperbolic space. And the way that they engineer that here is just by putting in like way more waveguide, basically. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. So that's basically it for hyperbolic space. And I want to talk to you about something. This story is not 100% relevant, but I think it is the most elegant way to introduce aperiodic tilings and quasicrystals. I think it's just spectacular. So given a set of prototiles, which we'll just, prototiles by definition are things that are like going to be our fundamental units of our quasicrystal. So given a set of prototiles, like maybe these ones here on the right, right? With the rule that colors must match along edges. So you're going to try and you're going to stick these prototiles together into a tiling with the rule that like if it's red, it has to touch another red, something like this, right? Question, can you use them to tile the plane? Okay, seems like an innocent question. And then more specifically, is there an algorithm to determine if they tile the plane, if this some set of prototiles tiles the plane? Okay, so options. There's three options. This is not hard logic here. Either they do not tile the plane. You can never put them together in a way that they tile the plane. They tile the plane, and at least somewhere in that many, many possible ways that they could possibly tile the plane, they admit a periodic tiling. Okay. Or the third option, they tile the plane, but they never, in any way that you try to do it, you can never make a periodic tiling. And in that case, tau, the prototile set, will be called an aperiodic set, because they are never capable of tiling the plane periodically. Okay, so this is a fact. I cannot prove this fact for you. It is much too difficult. There exists an algorithm to determine if tau tiles the plane, if and only if all possible tile sets are of type 1 or type 2. Okay. And then the second fact is that there turns out, so that this first fact was proven in 1961 by Hao Wang. And the second fact was proven by a student much later in 1966. Okay, so this second fact, there is a map from Turing machines, M, to tile sets, tau of M, such that M halts if and only if tau M tiles the plane. So what does this mean? The logic here is a little bit hard to follow, but the logic is from this, you can determine an aperiodic set, a tile set must exist. So the logic is as follows. People have probably heard something like the halting problem is undecidable. Right? So you can't, so the logic is as follows. You can't determine if M halts. That's what people mean when they say the halting problem is undecidable. Step of logic two, using the last exclamation mark, you can't determine if tau M tiles the plane. Okay. And then because of that, from the first exclamation mark, you determine not all tiles, not all protosets are. Not all prototiles, tau, are type 1 or type 2. And then, of course, there must be one of type 3. Okay, so that's an insane proof that aperiodic tiles exist, just formed out of squares, colored squares. Okay, and there's a fun game you can play. I mean, maybe it's not fun at this point. It's probably just tedious because mathematicians have made it so perfect. You can try to see how small you can make the prototile set and how simple you can make this set of prototiles and still have an aperiodic set. I don't know what the latest number is. I mean, I think it's got to be less than 5. It might even be lower. Okay. Sorry. Yes?
Actually, I don't understand this logic.
So the logic is you can't determine if a Turing machine halts. That's a famous result. Okay. Because you can't determine if Turing machine halts, from this true theorem here, you can't determine if tau m tiles the plane, where tau m is a set of tiles made that come from this map from Turing machines to tiles. From this first fact from 1961, you cannot conclude that all tiles are of type 1 or type 2. And so not all tiles are type 1 or type 2. Some have to be of type 3. And type 3 includes aperiodic tiles. All right, yeah, so it's a long chain of logic, but I think it's just, it's hilarious how it kind of things people stumble upon. Okay, so now I want to just describe for you quickly what a quasicrystal is. So quasicrystals are aperiodic tilings, which still possess some amount of order, okay? So aperiodic, again, means they have no translation symmetry by any amount at all in any direction, okay? So quasicrystals are particularly interesting because they possess classically forbidden symmetries, and they also spoil many classical intuitions about physics. So actually, the 2011 Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to Daniel Shechtman for his 1984 work called Metallic Phase with Long-Range Orientational Order and No Translational Symmetry. And basically, the if I'm going to boil it all down to one thing, what he did was is he found some crystal, and then he looked at the diffraction pattern of that crystal. And then if you take a look at this crystal here, for example, this is actually not the crystal he used, but this is a much cleaner sample. You take a look at this pattern here, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So it has tenfold rotational symmetry. And from our crystallographic restriction theorem from earlier, such things should not be allowed. Okay, this is not an allowed diffraction pattern if he was actually describing a regular crystal. You know, there's this sort of thing that, okay, maybe he didn't find a crystal. He found what people would eventually call a quasicrystal. That was actually contentious for a while. And although in modern times, we now have like tunneling microscopy. And so we don't have to just look at the diffraction pattern. We can actually just take a real space picture of the lattice. And it's hard to see, but I think this is the coolest picture. So you can actually go and you can actually check and see that it actually looks like a quasicrystal and has forbidden, it has a forbidden point group, classical point group, in the real space picture. And I also think this picture is cool because this picture actually comes from a meteorite. So quasicrystals show up in many places. They're built in labs, but they're also found in nature. So for example, Paul Steinhardt and some other people went to a meteorite impact site in Russia, and they basically found an actual quasicrystal at the impact site. So this is a picture. Okay. Quasicrystals also show up in condensed matter theory. So in study of lattice models, topological phases, right? People study the Ising model on a quasicrystal, things like this. Topological phases of matter. Dominic Els, who's here at PI, has done some work on such things. In pure math, so they show up in logic. I was just talking about the timings previously. They also show up in non-commutative geometry in a complicated way. They show up in high energy physics, so my claim is that maybe they show up in something related to holography. They also show up in 2D CFT. So for example, sort of intuition from quasicrystals might show up in 2D CFT is as follows, right? You imagine you're doing just a standard toroidal compactification, and the target is something like T squared. Then the Neurane lattice is actually going to, so let me read it like this. So you have P left and P right. Okay, and they basically act as if they're in a thing that's like R2 comma 2, quotiented by some self-dual even lattice. Okay, and so basically the idea is what I'm trying to say is like, for example, so what you can do is if you're studying something like orbifolds or something like this, you can study orbifolds that roughly speaking live in O2 comma 2, roughly in a four-dimensional lattice rather than just in a two-dimensional lattice. Maybe that was a little bit of a messy discussion, but the idea is you can take their symmetries that are sort of extra symmetries that are lurking as if or when you do a toroidal compactification, it's like you have symmetries and you can access symmetries that roughly speaking come from 2D dimensions rather than just D dimensions if you're studying like a torus with an RD mod some D rank D lattice. Okay, messy description, but sorry. Yes.
Context, are you referring to some
Neurane
CFT or some
symmetric product of people? Neurane CFT, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And then I'm basically saying because the Neurane lattice is basically 2D dimensional, you get access to extra symmetries you might not have. In the 2D case, because you were studying something like with a two-dimensional target, you would have thought, oh, there's no possible way I could quotient out by a five-fold symmetry. But five-fold symmetries do exist in four dimensions. Okay? And I mean, the answer is, you know, the conclusion of that is basically just that, you know, orbifolds don't always have a nice, like, target space description after you orbifold, right? Okay, so this was all just the introduction. So, like I said, hopefully I've kind of explained some history and everyone's kind of familiar with this story about classical crystals. And again, I'm going to just go through a little bit more rigor now, the details of hyperbolic lattices and quasicrystals. And assuming I don't go super over time, I will try to combine the two here. Okay? All right. So, in the Euclidean plane, the angle of a regular p-gon, so I denote that like this, is 1 minus 2 over p times pi. All right. So if I ask you what are the regular tilings of the plane, they're what I will call 3, 6, 6, 3, and 4, 4. So what this notation is called Schlaffy notation. And the way that Schlaffy notation works is quite simple. This says here that you're studying p-gons, or in this case, three-gons, or less obnoxiously, triangles, okay? And then this second number here says six meet around a point. Okay, so the six share a common vertex. And so this is just a very fancy way of saying you can only tile, the only regular tilings of the plane are by hexagons, equilateral triangles, or squares. Okay, and here's a picture of 6, 3 over here. So there's my sixes and 3 meet around a point. Easy peasy. Okay. And then in higher dimensions, if you want to study regular tessellations, you just have to make sure that the dihedral angles, aka like the fat angles in a solid, that they can also fit around an edge, and so on and so forth, up to higher dimension. Okay. In the hyperbolic plane, angles of a regular p-gon, so triangles, gradually decrease to zero as the edges get bigger. And when I say they get bigger, I mean bigger relative to the ADS length scale, right? So you can just fix that to one, so then you can just say, as the edges get bigger. And so what we can do then is we can roughly use this to tune the p-gons, their size and their edge lengths, to fit however many we want around a vertex, okay? And the general result I just quoted here is that if you want to study a PQ tiling, okay, and you look at this quantity, 1 over p plus 1 over q, if it's greater than a half, then PQ tessellates the sphere. If it's equal to a half, tessellates Euclidean plane. And if it's greater or less than a half, it tessellates hyperbolic space. So here's a picture of a, I believe, 4-6 tiling. This is one of M.C. Escher's circle limit pictures. And you can see here that this is a hyperbolic foregon. And it looks like there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them that meet around a point. So I conclude this is a 4-6 regular tiling of hyperbolic space. Okay. Okay, so I've also made a picture of all the regular tilings in 2D. So just to go over it, like I mentioned much earlier, tilings of the sphere are basically just related to polytopes. So here's a tetrahedron, the octahedron, the cube, the icosahedron, the dodecahedron. You can just blow those out. In the plane, it's just the square lattice, the triangular lattice, and a honeycomb lattice. And then I obviously can't draw them all in hyperbolic space because it's everything else. Okay, so there's just two random ones. Okay. So more generally, I can go to higher dimensions in hyperbolic space. I'm going to focus on hyperbolic space, but now let the dimension be arbitrary. So regular honeycombs in hyperbolic space are totally classified by Coxeter using, you know, standard group theoretical techniques and the theory of like reflection planes and that sort of thing. So as previously mentioned, PQ tessellates where 1 over P plus 1 over Q is less than a half. Then there are four regular tessellations in 3D. There are five regular tessellations in 4D. There are no regular tessellations in 5D unless you allow the cells of the regular polytope to have infinite volume. So roughly speaking, if you imagine hyperbolic space as being a big ball, there are some vertices that can kiss all the way out to the boundary. So roughly speaking, there's none in 5D. And then even if you have that requirement, there's literally none at all when D is greater than 5. Okay. I should just explain this notation here. So what this notation would be, if I just focus on this here, because I described the previous one, is first we read it like this. And let me actually focus on this other one, because it's on the picture on the right. Maybe it doesn't help. Actually, this might be a good time. So I have some icosahedra. Does anybody want some? It may help. And if nobody's, people are afraid to just take the icosahedra, I can, you want one? Okay, here you go. They're a little bit delicate. Here you are. Okay, here, you can get a nice origami one. You can have an origami one too. Anybody else, icosahedra?
Yes, please.
Okay, you can have this big one. Other ones? You want one? All right, I see Hank wants one. Okay, because we're going to be, oh, sorry. We're going to be coming back to the icosahedra. So is anybody in the back one? Okay, you guys can share one. We're going to be coming back to the icosahedra because part of the proof later is going to be you're just going to have to like squint your eyes really hard and like stare. So to avoid just having mathematical jargon everywhere. So, okay. Yes. I did. Okay. Yeah. So let me just briefly go over how to read this notation, okay? So the notation is as follows. Three means we study triangles. And if you put five triangles around a point, what does it collapse into? It collapses into an icosahedron, okay? And then the next one, this three here, says that three icosahedra meet around an edge. So if you hold your one icosahedron, then you pretended I made way more, you could imagine trying to stick them next to each other. And you'd see that in Euclidean space, they almost fit, but like not really. I think the dihedral angle of an icosahedron in Euclidean space is very close to 120 degrees, so it's very tempting, but it's not exactly 120 degrees. It's obviously helpful to have more than one when you're actually trying to understand these things. And then the same arguments go in higher dimensions, okay? So this is a picture of that 353 honeycomb. So it becomes a honeycomb in hyperbolic space because you start putting three icosahedra around every edge of the icosahedron in hyperbolic space, okay? And this is a picture of somebody kind of living inside this honeycomb. Here's another picture of that hyperbolic honeycomb. It's just a little bit of a finite patch of it, and it's been 3D printed by somebody with way too much time on their hands. Okay. It's actually very useful. They actually have a paper on how to visualize, it's called Visualizing Hyperbolic Honeycombs, and it's actually very useful. So, all right. So that's going to be it for honeycombs, but everyone can hold on to their icosahedra because they will be relevant later depending on how far we make it. Okay? So I want to just come back to quasicrystals. I already mentioned they're apiotic tilings that still possess order, and apiotic means no translational symmetry by any amount at all. Now, the unfortunate fact is that there's actually no agreed upon definition of a quasicrystal, okay? But for us, it will be that their reciprocal lattice is spanned by integer linear combinations of greater than d basis vectors in d dimensions, okay? And that actually sort of comes back to that diffraction picture, which I showed all those slides ago, because if you actually think about this, what our argument from, enhanced closed captioning, thank you. Okay, so if you actually come back to this picture here and you think about our proof of the no fivefold symmetry in 2D, points in this diffraction pattern can actually become arbitrarily close together. So if there was no cutoff, for example, in a realistic experiment, you would actually find that between any two Bragg peaks, there's another Bragg peak and so on and so forth, they densely fill the plane. So if you had like a perfect machine, this picture would just be pure white, okay? So in some sense, it's good intuition. It's good intuition to say that to define them by their diffraction pattern if you really want to study these physical things. Now, another fact about quasicrystals is that there are many ways to create a quasicrystal, all of which are equivalent, not all of which produce everything that some other person might call a quasicrystal. There's four popular ones. I won't go through them all, but one is by local matching rules. That's similar to those Wong tiles that we discussed earlier about the sticking the squares together. And there's Amann lines. I won't talk about this one, but that's how you, each one kind of highlights different properties of it. So these Amann lines highlight the long range order that exists in quasicrystals. There's a cut and project method, which we will go over. And these nicely highlight why forbidden symmetries show up, and substitution rules show why aperiodicity shows up. Now, this picture up here in the top right is a picture of what's called the Penrose tiling. So the Penrose tiling is made out of this fat rhombus and this thin rhombus. And the rule is that like arrows have to click up together. And then it's a fact that if you do this with these local matching rules defined here, and you click them together, if you have these, there is no possible way that you can produce a tiling of the plane using those Penrose tiles here to produce anything that is not aperiotic. Okay? In other words, this is an aperiotic set of prototiles. Okay, so that's local matching rules. I think those are self-explanatory. So let me talk about this thing called cut and project. Cut and project is the way that especially people who do condensed matter theory really love to study these things, and also the thing I said earlier about 2D CFT, if it parsed. This is also what people do. So you take some regular lattice in 2D dimensions. In this case, 2D is just equal to 2. Okay, in two dimensions in this case. And then you take a cut at an irrational angle. You take this irrational cut. Okay, and then what you do is you kind of have this little acceptance band. You have this fat little acceptance band highlighted here in gold. And then you basically drag that acceptance band out along your cut. And then you take every single lattice site which shows up in the cut, and you project it down onto a 1D line. Okay, and then this 1D line will be a quasicrystal. It'll be a quasi-periodic pattern. Okay, the natural case. So, like I said, Penrose tiling is great. It'll be sort of the other star of our story alongside the icosahedron, okay? And, I said there's no definition of a quasicrystal, but if your definition does not include the Penrose tiling, it's not a good definition, okay? And so in the case of the Penrose tiling, you take the A4 lattice, which is a regular lattice in four dimensions, and then you cut it at an irrational angle and you project and it produces the Penrose tiling. Okay? So there's another way to produce Penrose tilings, and that's by substitution rules. So the way that the substitution rule works is quite as follows. You define two tiles. Here they're also marked with the local matching rules, but that's not necessary. You just define two shapes, a blue shape and a red shape. Okay? You can pretend those matching rules aren't there. And then you define a way to replace one blue shape with some collection of blue and red shapes, or a red shape with some collection of red and blue shapes. And then, given some conditions on your substitution rule, these will produce a periodic tiling. So here's an example. And so if you want to actually produce a tiling, what you'll do is you'll start with some seed in the plane. So here's a seed of like five tiles, okay? And then you just inflate once, it produces this, inflate again, produces that, and you just inflate further and further out, and then eventually you'll produce one Penrose tiling. Okay. Now, I just want to give a very quick proof of why, if you define a quasicrystal using substitution rules, that it implies it's aperiodic. So the logic here is a little bit involved again, but it's not a big deal. So start with a finite set of possibly decorated prototiles. T1 through TN. And then suppose there is a unique rule for grouping prototiles into larger super tiles. So in this case, right, this is the prototile, and this is a prototile, and this is the super tile, right? Okay, suppose there is, and this the key word here is unique. There is a unique rule for grouping them into larger super tiles with some relevant scale factor lambda, how much bigger they get. Okay, then the conclusion is that tau is an aperiodic set. Okay. And so the logic for this is as follows. If you can group them, if you can group them uniquely into larger and larger tiles, and what you can, and you suppose, for example, suppose they had a translational symmetry by some amount. So suppose they had translational symmetry by some amount L translational, okay? And what you can do is you can just take the tiling and you can basically encode the tiling uniquely into bigger and bigger tiles until the smallest in radius, so basically the smallest dimension relevant anywhere in the problem, is smaller than that length L, or sorry, larger than that length L, and then that tiling couldn't possibly have L-fold translational symmetry. Okay, so that logic was maybe a little bit involved, but okay. So again, it's just you can basically uniquely re-encode the tiling into something that it couldn't possibly have L-fold translational symmetry. So it couldn't be that your original tiling had L-fold translational symmetry. Okay, so that's the conclusion that if there's a unique way to do it, then it's an aperiodic set. So in the case of the Penrose tiling, there are two prototiles, and the super tiles have a growth factor like this. Let me give a non-example. There is no unique way to group an unmarked square tiling into larger tiles, and domain walls can form. So this is actually interesting if you have any intent on maybe trying to connect quasicrystals to the ability to do scale transformations. Because if you tried to group tiles up in the plane using just local rules, so I might do it here. I could make a square here. I could send out all my little drones, and they could group up tiles here. And then my other drone might go, and he might group up a square here, and then there's some guy who might go out and he might group up this square here, and you can see that you sort of start to form domain walls, right? There's no unique way to take a square tiling. You can always decimate the square tiling in smaller and smaller ways, but you can't uniquely regroup it, okay? And that's one of the nice properties about these things described by these self-similar aperiodic tilings, okay? And very roughly speaking, this property comes from the fact that this is an irrational number, whereas in the square case, it would be a rational number. And I mean, I'm kind of just asserting this by numerology, but that is roughly where it comes from. And that irrational number also comes from the fact that this was an irrational cut, taken at an irrational angle, things like this. Okay, I'm not going to prove this. Okay, and we can sort of capture the combinatorial information about this in what's called a substitution matrix. Okay. And in the case when you actually study the substitution matrix, the dominant eigenvalue in the substitution matrix is greater than 1, and it's also irrational. It's usually a power of that scale factor. So let me just give a concrete example. In the case of the Penrose tiling, a thin rhombus turned into half a thick, and two halves of a thin. So it turned into one thin and one thick, etc. so on and so forth. And then if you just take a look at the eigenvalues of this matrix, you'll find that there's one greater than one. There's one and only one greater than one. And it's lambda squared. It's this lambda squared here. And then you'll also see that it has one less than one. And it's roughly speaking the conjugate, where I mean like, you know, if you, okay, I mean it's like, you know, something like square root 5 minus 1 over 2 squared, something like that. Okay. All right. So there's also these weird connections to number theory, but those won't be relevant to us. Okay, and then one other fun fact about Penrose tilings that I want to talk about is, which is somewhat relevant to us, is how many Penrose tilings are there? Okay, so answer, it's right on the slide. There are an uncountable infinity of Penrose tilings. Okay, so that is to say, I mean, there's only two proto-tiles, but there are an uncountable infinite number of ways to put them together. Okay, now, so by that logic, if you look at this picture that I've shown here on the right, you'd say, oh, Justin, you've only shown me a picture of one Penrose tiling, right? There's an uncountable infinity, and you're only going to show me one picture? Well, it turns out that they also have this nice property that Penrose tilings are locally indistinguishable. So if you take any finite size patch of any tiling, it can be found inside any other tiling, okay? So if you do this, so then I actually say to you, no, you know, it turns out I'm actually showing you a picture of all the Penrose tilings when I show you this picture, because this picture here exists in any other Penrose tiling. Okay. The way that you distinguish them is somehow by global information. So you could say, but I have very good eyes. I can zoom out all the way to infinity, and I can see the whole Penrose tiling at once, and I can tell that they're globally distinct, and you have not shown me all of the Penrose tilings, and then you'd win. Okay. And so Penrose tilings have some sort of, so my argument is that somehow in this story I'm going to tell that, you know, hyperbolic space is going to be like anti-de Sitter space in ADS-CFT, and quasicrystals are going to somehow be some discretization, the right way to discretize having scale invariance, or like discretize CFTs. And so Penrose tilings, and these things defined by these aperiodic substitution rules, have local scale symmetry, right? So you can take any tiling, you can decimate it into the smaller Penrose tiling that lives underneath. Okay, you can rescale it by lambda, and then this new tiling is locally indistinguishable from the original. It's globally distinct, possibly, but locally indistinguishable. Okay.
Sorry, can I ask on the second?
Yes.
So locally distinct. So I thought before that, like, starting from some finite size seed,
yes,
you can continue tiling and like write the whole tiling in a unique way. That's not true, yeah.
It's. Right. So, I mean, it'll really, so you can start with different seeds, basically, and then you're basically taking, yeah, you can start with different seeds, basically, is the answer.
But if you start from the same seed, like, I still have many different ways to continue that.
Right. And once you've done sort of roughly a lot, like an infinite number of things, you can still do one more and then produce something, like, you know, you can produce something else, too, that might be globally distinct. Is that it? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so to recap, if you haven't, you know, you're checking emails or something, hyperbolic space, it exists. You can tile it with regular tessellations. Okay, here's another M.C. Escher picture. There are infinitely many tilings in 2D and a handful more in higher dimensions. Quasicrystals, they also exist. They're aperiodic. They have classically forbidden symmetries. They have long-range order, which I didn't go over. If people are interested, there's extra slides for that. But we're on time. And so they have long-range order. There are many constructions. The most useful for us is going to be the existence of a unique invertible local substitution rule with an irrational scale factor, lambda. And the most famous example is the Penrose tiling. Okay. Here's a Penrose tiling with some five-fold symmetry. Okay, so let's see. I just had a question, but are there any other questions? Because this seems like be a natural point to go over questions, and then I'm going to get into new stuff. Hello, Hank.
I'm just wondering about the uncountable.
Yeah.
You mean like the tile set?
Yeah.
And then the rewrite rules or the substitution rules are still countable.
Yes.
So how do I get uncountable?
You can just start with, I mean, you can start with an initial seed, which is weird, or you can start with, like, you know, very simple. You could also start with an initial seed, which is, like, arbitrarily more complicated and inflate from that. I mean,
but each step is, like discrete.
Yeah, but yes. Probably. Yeah. What's the axiom of choice among friends? I don't know. But you're right. So the clearest proof is actually not by using this logic. There's a nice proof by Conway. I think it's in this Martin Gardner article on Penrose tilings. And it's kind of weird. So you start with Penrose tiling. You start with a Penrose tiling, and then you do something like you start at a point, and then you assign it 0 if it's inside a thick rhombus, and 1 if it's inside a thin rhombus, and then you apply the substitution rules to it, and you can show that you basically can construct arbitrarily complicated binary strings, and you know you can produce like arbitrarily complicated like real numbers of binary strings or something. It's involved, so yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about this 2D, 1D story a bit, and I might need to take a seat for this because I might have to do some drawing. So, okay, M. Right. Okay, M. So the story is basically as follows. I'm going to illustrate it in this case of a 7-3 tiling and a 3-7 tiling. So this picture here that I've drawn, this picture is a triangulation of hyperbolic space by triangles that are common to both the 3-7 tiling and the 7-3 tiling. The reason why I'm describing the picture this way is because it's definitely the more general answer, and I think it's much more elegant. Okay. So the first thing is I want to describe what I mean by growing. So here I have some finite patch of hyperbolic space, and it's in the 7-3 tiling. It's shown in yellow. Okay. And then by growing it, what I mean is I'm just going to take this neighboring 3-7 tiling, so where three triangles meet around, or sorry, seven triangles meet around a point, and it's dual to it, and I can grow it. See, so I can just make this next patch of tiling. It is the sort of natural next patch of tiling that comes from the previous one. One way to understand it is that the centers of all these triangles are basically lying on vertices in the previous tiling. Okay. So that's what I will call the growth rule for the bulk. Okay, and then my claim is that there's a quasicrystal lurking somewhere around here. And the claim, now this is through painstaking guess and check and redefining things and things like that, and I'm just going to tell you the answer. The answer is that the right way to label the boundary to identify a quasicrystal in this picture is to go to some vertex on the boundary and then to basically just label it with a number saying how many things in the bulk it's connected to. So in this case here in the yellow tiling, I'll make it smaller. It'd be 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, okay? And then on the boundary, it's something like 2, 3, 2, 2, 2, 3, 2, 2, 2, 3, 2, 2, okay? So I claim that that's the right way to do it, okay? And then, so that's what I mean by, so what have I defined for you? I've defined for you what it means to grow the bulk. I've defined to you what it means to pass to the boundary data. And then I claim that growing the bulk, it does a inflation on the boundary. And it does it in such a way that it is like it's a self-similar substitution rule. Okay? And so we can actually just kind of guess what the substitution rules will be. So in the yellow tiling, in the boundary of the yellow tiling, tiles are labeled by ones and twos. Okay. They can be ones or twos. Oh, I should make them the right color. Be ones or twos, okay? And if we just stare at the picture long enough, I mean, what does it look like? It kind of looks like ones, roughly speaking, go to twos. You know, this two here goes to like a three, but it kind of, you know, kind of maybe screws up because this one is here. And the answer is basically, we can just check it, so I'll write it down. The answer is that, maybe I'll write this part in black. Okay, the answer is that a one goes to, and I'll write it like this with fractional powers, just for elegance sake, okay? It goes to something like this, okay? So, I mean, you can kind of see it, right? This one here, it's kind of causing half of this two and half of this two. He's causing half of this two, ooh, but, you know, and he causes half of a two here, but, oh, this guy luckily has a 2^-1/2, so it kind of cancels out. Now, because everything at this point has been very geometric, you're probably saying, okay, this seems like a little bit BS. You're using these things, you're using like using fractional powers of tiles and negative powers of tiles. That's super weird. So my answer to that is, yeah, that does seem weird. So I have two caveats to it. One is that you can actually pick different labeling schemes so that you don't have to use these fractional powers of tiles and the negative powers of tiles, but I just find that they're particularly elegant and they make things more symmetric. And the other thing is we can actually give geometric meaning to what is meant by fractional powers of tiles and also negative powers of tiles. And so actually it turns out to be consistent, and this is really important later. So I think that's nice. And then I won't torture you with trying to derive the other one, but if I also then tried to study how this 2 and this 3 evolved, okay, the 2 would evolve into something like 2 to the 1 half, 1 cubed, 2 to the 1 half, and the 3 would evolve into a 2 to the 1 half, 1 squared, 2 to the 1 half. And if you think anything here is suspicious, just please ask, and because, you know, I've tried to make sure that everything is actually logically consistent. So if you write something with a negative fractional power, it has to mean something. It can't just be an algebraic trick. Okay? So let me just sort of show you how you can derive this rule in an arbitrary 2D, 1D tiling. So suppose I have some PQ surface here. So this is P-gons, or Q meter around a vertex, and this is the surface here. Okay? And then suppose that this here is an N vertex, so it's connected to N P-gons that meet here at this point. Okay. And what you can do is you can say, okay, at the next layer, there's going to be a Q-gon. It wraps around that vertex. So this is a Q-gon. Q-gon. Okay. N of its vertices are inside, right? They're in here, inside the bulk P-gons. So N of its vertices are inside. And Q minus N of its vertices are on the outside. Okay? Q minus N of its vertices are on the outside. I guess there's maybe one more. It looks something like this. These are where the Q minus N vertices live. Okay? And then basically the one that's closest to, you know, the one that's closest to the surface on either side, this one is going to be shared with its neighbors, and it's going to be shared with one neighbor. So this, roughly speaking, will prove the general rule that one n vertex goes to a 2 to the 1 half, 1 to the q minus n minus 2, 2 to the 1 half. Okay? So that's the general rule. Okay? And if there's no problems with it, then I will just, if there's no questions or comments about it, then I will just move on. Okay? We're doing great on time. And I won't keep people long for lunch. Okay? So, to summarize the claim is that if you take a patch of eight, is there a question? No? Okay. If you take a patch of hyperbolic space like this, you can grow it into the bulk. It grows like this. Or you can pass to this boundary string that looks like this. And growing in the bulk is equivalent to inflating on the boundary, where this inflation is a self-similar aperiodic substitution rule. Okay? And, you know, there's a little bit of global, you know, this quasi-crystal does have a little bit of rotational symmetry. I mean, you know, it comes from the fact that, you know, you can see that this thing has some sort of three, like a Z3 symmetry coming from the fact this bulk had itself some Z3 symmetry. But locally, it looks like a quasi-crystal. There's only a little bit of global ambiguity. And as we take the number of inflations out to infinity, the claim is that we get a full quasi-crystal, like a proper quasi-crystal. Right. And yeah, so the claim is basically that this diagram commutes. Okay. This inflation is definitely local. I mean, you can see that just from the way that I define it on the tiles. So it's definitely a local rule. It's invertible mostly. I mean, I will spill the beans now and say, like, it is basically invertible. You might try to ask, okay, you might think, like, yeah, you try to be very clever and you try to engineer some sort of scenario that's like maybe not simply connected, or it has two things merging, and then, oh, what happens to your substitution rules then? The substitution rules actually turn out to be much smarter than you think, but for simplicity, let's just assume everything is simply connected. We start with simply connected patches in the bulk and things like that, right? But yeah, like, you know, you might try to say, oh, what if I made like a big horseshoe shape, right? And then I inflated it 10 times. How would it know that it's any different from if I just made a full donut and then inflated it, right? Like, how does it know that it's, you know, if you do 10 inflations, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just gonna be some big ball. How would you know? It turns out that the inflation rules are more clever than you'd think. And actually, it also turns out that I drew on these arrows one direction, this passing to the boundary, but you can also basically, up to, again, some topological subtleties, recreate the boundary configuration or the bulk configuration from this boundary string. Okay, so it doesn't seem like there's lots of data about the bulk configuration that's being encoded in these boundary strings. Okay, and so like I was mentioning earlier, there's lots of work being done on this by, for example, Joan Erdmanger's group and things like that, where they will study, they'll put a quantum field theory, they'll put some spin system on this lattice, and then they'll basically study things like the BF bounds or something like that. I mean, you know, the picture is inspired by holography, but I personally am not claiming, you know, we should do discrete holography this way, but I wanted to stress that this is a strictly correct mathematical result, and people can do whatever they want with it. Okay, but I think it would be interesting. You know, this does spur on various conjectures, so it seems like there is some sort of very rigorous relationship between things in H squared and quasicrystals in 1D. Okay, and so I think it would be very interesting that for example, put the Ising model in hyperbolic space and then also put it on a 1D quasicrystal. And because, at criticality, the ADS is like, BCFT, maybe you could relate critical exponents in, maybe you could relate critical exponents in one to critical exponents in the other or something. I don't know. Okay. So are there any questions about this? Because then we're going to come back to the icosahedra that I handed out. Seems straightforward, right? Grow in the bulk, inflation on the boundary. Possibly invertible, mostly invertible. Well, invertible here in this sense, and also reversible. Maybe I should use the word reverse. Make sense?
What do you mean by critical exponents in this model?
Well, I just mean like if you did, I'm just conjecturing a thing for condensed matter-minded people to do, which is, could you put, if there is actually a relationship between hyperbolic lattices and quasicrystals, could you put some spin system on them, and then could you actually study that that the physics of hyperbolic space tells you about the something of physics of quasicrystals in one-dimensional array. So I don't know what you check, critical exponents or something. I don't know. Okay.
What's the state of our Ising model looking into this kind of
stuff? Yeah. So in hyperbolic space, not very good actually. There's some Monte Carlo stuff, things like that. I've tried taking a peek. On the other hand, understanding things like spin systems on quasicrystals is there's much more literature on that. I personally don't know like who's doing the best work on this. I don't know if really, yeah. And I don't know if anybody's tried to combine them either or tried to like match things from one to the other, except for this work by Joanna's group. Very recent. Okay. So yeah, I'm going to try and talk a little bit about higher dimensions, and we have 7 minutes left, and so it's going to go lightning fast, but that's kind of the point. Let me just kind of point out why we should do this in higher dimensions, besides the fact that you might want to study, lattice models in higher dimensions. Well, the problem is you can think about it in a slightly conceptual way. I mean, if you're just posing a strict mathematical problem even, and you claim, there's a relationship between hyperbolic crystals in d dimensions or d plus one dimensions and quasicrystals in one dimension lower, the problem is that 1D is kind of too topological, right? There's no curvature in 1D space. And so questions like, where does the tile live? What is the length of a tile? It's basically meaningless, right? Because, I mean, like you say, where does the, like, what is the length of these one and two tiles here? I go, okay, well, like, I don't know, it's like this much or it's just whatever. Like, I can just make it up because again, it's really just, there's only a string in 1D. There's no geometry happening in 1D. So the question is this really a relationship between geometry of hyperbolic tessellation and quasicrystals, or is it just a coincidence because some irrational numbers showed up in the growing of hyperbolic quasicrystals?
I mean, yeah. If you calculate the eigenvector of the substitution metric, you can get the length of each string.
Yes, you can do that, but I still don't know if it's exactly. Yeah, I agree. I just don't know if is it meaningful? I don't know, right? But I guess I'm really just trying to stress the fact that there's no geometry, right? It's just like a way for labeling, for obtaining strings obtained by self-similar substitution rules. Yeah, totally right. So the natural question is, can we identify a similar relationship in higher dimensions? Recall in H3 that there were four regular tessellations. This is the one with the icosahedron, again drawn here. You can stare at your icosahedron. You can try to pretend you're in this big this big nest here, okay, of icosahedra. And there's this conjecture in so lots of this work was actually, some of this work was done by Latham earlier, and part of this 2D, 1D story I've told you is a significant refinement of this story in the paper, in 2019 paper, also with Dickens and Flicker, I believe. And so this is a conjecture of Latham, is that the boundary, so if you do the same story for this 3-5-3 tiling, which is the one made out of icosahedra, which has fivefold symmetry, what could it be? It has to be the Penrose tiling. If it's going to be anything, it's going to be the Penrose tiling, right? And roughly speaking, anything with fivefold symmetry in any quasi-periodic pattern in 2D with fivefold symmetry is basically the Penrose tiling or a very close cousin of the Penrose tiling. So, like, again, what else could it be? And when Roger Penrose was visiting PI, we told him about this, and he basically mentioned that there was actually a very similar conjecture by Bill Thurston saying that, oh, if you take horospheres that cut, so horospheres are roughly speaking, if you imagine you're in the upper half space model of hyperbolic space, horospheres are things that basically lie at constant z, and you cut along horospheres, that you also produce a Penrose tiling. And these conjectures are roughly equivalent, okay? We can go into the details afterwards if people care, okay? So I'm going to try and resolve this conjecture in 2 minutes. It goes roughly as follows. So we're going to think very carefully about how the bulk 3D grows, and then we'll make a careful analogy to 2D. And I'm going to try to argue to you that the boundary tile data is encoded in the species and relative configurations of boundary vertices, okay? So imagine you start with a single icosahedron, just for simplicity. So if you have one in front of you, you can imagine you have it, okay? All of the vertices are so-called one vertices because they're all just connected to one thing in the bulk, right? This is my initial seed, for simplicity, right? We can study more arbitrarily complicated things, but for simplicity, okay? So all vertices are one vertices, and all vertices, or all edges, they bow outwards, okay? So the dual tiling to this, so it's 3-5-3 tiling. So the dual tiling is just what happens if you reverse this. So it is also a 3-5-3 tiling, it's self-dual. So the dual tiling will also be tiled by icosahedra as well. So a cell in the dual honeycomb will be an icosahedron, one of the icosahedra you have, wrapping a vertex of the old tiling. So if you have a picture like this, and this is our one vertex out on the boundary, right? And what's going to happen is there's going to be a new icosahedron. It will have this vertex at its center. So let's see, future center of a new icosahedron, okay, in the next layer. And the edges of this new icosahedron, they're going to puncture the faces of this old icosahedron dead in the center, okay, in the midpoint. And the new icosahedron will itself, much like the 2D story, it will have one vertex that's sort of buried in the old one. Why will it have one? It will have one because this in the old one was a one vertex, right? Sort of makes sense. And so if we glom on all of the new icosahedra, we will clearly have a slightly larger bulk tiling. And for people online, I'm very sorry, but I'm doing things with my hands right now, so think hard. You'll clearly have a new tiling, and what's going to happen is going to be bigger, it's going to be bulkier, it'll still have icosahedral symmetry, and there'll be 12 icosahedra total in this tiling, engulfing the old one. And there's 12 because there were 12 vertices in the previous one, right? Okay. Yeah. So now let's think of an icosahedron in the new layer of 12, right? So in the new layer of 12, right? So let's pretend this guy is one guy who's in the new layer of 12. What's there going to be? There's going to be one buried vertex here. Okay, so this is buried. Okay. On these edges here, there's going to be 5 places where those edges are puncturing faces of the previous layer. Okay. There's going to be 5 shared vertices. I'll draw them in red circles. Okay, there's 5 shared vertices. These will be shared amongst 3 icosahedra, right? Because much like the same way how when I drew the picture of the arbitrary inflation rule before, there was that one guy who was really close to the boundary and he was shared amongst 2. These guys very close to the surface, and I'm growing upwards in this picture, right? They will be shared amongst 3. So there'll be 5 shared 3 vertices, okay? There will be, I will use another color, there will be some shared edges, okay? All those shared edges around there. And then finally, there will be 12 there will be however many is left of one vertices. Everything else will be one vertices, okay? And you can do this for, you know, any sort of tiling. And so I'm going to show you this picture, and it looks completely insane right now, but what this is in black is what happens when you do that for one icosahedron, and then the black is 12 icosahedra, and then the red is one inflation left, and then I've projected it down onto flat space. And so just as a sanity check, I can explain to you what all these things are, right? But roughly speaking, solid lines are saying it bows outwards, and dashed lines are saying it bows inwards, and you can basically just stare at this picture forever. And if you stare at the picture forever, and you go slightly over time, you'll basically find that there are ways to identify some tiles. You can naturally identify these geometric tiles that sit above all the vertices, and they nicely recreate this previous picture. And so the conclusion is as follows. There's three natural tiles in the growth of a single icosahedral cell. Okay, and with more complicated starting configurations than just that one single icosahedra, you can like identify other tiles. But it turns out that you can basically boil it down. So, and these tiles define a consistent 2D aperiodic substitution rule. Okay. Using further constraints like the Euler characteristic, you can show, similar to 2D, that you actually can boil all of this down to just two being encoded in two very complicated tiles, which don't have this neat geometric interpretation, but you can basically boil all the essential data down into just two prototiles, and so it looks really like it's going to be the Penrose tiling. And also, if you take a look at the resulting growth factor, the growth factor is very, very related to the Penrose tiling, but it's the Penrose tiling squared. Okay, so a priori, this doesn't mean the answer is wrong, because perhaps you just didn't find a fine-grained enough set of boundary tiles. But by thinking hard about the space of Penrose tilings, so there are some Penrose tilings, and they all have points of local fivefold symmetry, but there are only four that have global fivefold symmetry, you can actually show that there is no refinement that will produce Penrose tilings, because you can't basically successfully reproduce these Penrose tilings. And so Thurston and Boyle's conjecture appears to be false. I know that was very fast, but that's basically the gist of it. And so let me wrap up. So I just want to point out that hyperbolic lattices and quasicrystals, they exist, and there appears to be a relationship between them. Okay. A conjecture for the future is, what does the topping out of regular lattices in hyperbolic four space mean? I think it just means that, you know, this relationship is more general, and probably you should study things that are more beyond just regular lattices, but just arbitrary tessellations of hyperbolic space, but that would be very difficult. And the key point is that there's new quasi-periodic patterns. So, you know, I haven't 100% proven it for you folks here, but we have some 2D quasicrystal with fivefold symmetry, okay? And like I previously mentioned, they're all usually the Penrose tiling or close cousin, okay? But we seem to have produced a new fivefold symmetric quasicrystal using these hyperbolic space techniques. So in the 1D case, we were really just producing things that people already knew, but it seems like we produce a genuinely new species of pattern from this boundary of hyperbolic tessellations, okay? I have a conjecture for quasicrystal nerds here. And then finally, applications to physics, because this is supposed to be a physics talk, and I would just love to know if we could extend these results of Erdmenger et al. To higher dimensions. So yeah, that's the end of the talk, and there's backup slides if people care. Hello.
So for these not quite Penrose tilings that you get,
yes.
Have some of the nice properties, like can I encode a binary string in there, and then can I see that binary string somehow in the original in the ball?
Okay, so your question, can you reproduce the bulk configuration from the boundary?
No. Question is, the proof that we knew
that there are
uncountably many tiling. Can I do the same thing on this?
And yeah.
If I can I see the consequences of that in the bulk?
Right. Okay. That's a great question. Had not thought about that. So I don't know. The short answer is I don't know. And I don't think I'm going to answer the question. So, you know, if anybody has a recreational math hobby, that seems like a thing to check out. But yeah, that's a good question for what it would mean for the bulk. Other questions, comments?
I couldn't hear the full question. Sorry, this is Latham just chiming in. But there are uncountably many for the same reason as for Penrose tilings.
Yeah.
But the number of faces only countable.
The number of faces of what?
Initial faces.
Is countable?
Yeah. Oh. No, okay.
So I just wanted to make a comment that relating to like the stuff that you said about the Eisenmodel. So there are actually some works by Tiang and Bumi about like the topological phases in the hyperbolic plane. But it's continuous. Like they're doing like orbital K theory on non-commutative hyperbolic spaces, and then they prove like bulk boundary conjecture, bulk boundary correspondence rather. So it's in the continuum where we don't actually tessellate the. But if you say like, oh, these topological results should have a corresponding like lattice realization,
mm-hmm.
something like that, then maybe there is something to be said about like the stuff that you mentioned here.
Right.
So there is some kind of quantum spin chain on the quasi crystal that actually carries these like angling edge modes or something like that.
Right. So another testable one, another thing somebody could try and test.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's known and continuum.
Right.
A few more words about how to reconstruct the geometry from.
Yeah. So roughly speaking, the way that this is encoded is it's very simple, right? So I mean, you could imagine, so imagine you start at some starting point, okay, and then you're like a little computer who's allowed, or a little robot that's allowed to walk along the edges, okay? It's quite simple. Roughly speaking, what these numbers are basically telling you to do is, like, you know, you're coming up to an intersection of possible ways that you could go. You're a robot and you're trying to walk around the perimeter, okay, just from having this string, okay? And so you basically just have to decide what to do when you come up to an intersection. And the idea is by telling you this number, you're basically telling you, oh, do I take the first intersection to my left, the second intersection to my, you know, like, you kind of see what I'm saying? Like, I'm just kind of basically telling you how many intersections to your left you go, and then you walk along that. That's basically what it is. Does that kind of make sense? It's like you're programming a little robot who walks around the boundary. And so that's the way that they re-encode the bulk, because you're just carving out the perimeter by basically telling you what to do at each of the intersections. Okay. That was fast, but
How would that algorithm run there?
How would this argument work here? Okay. All right, let's see. So pretend I'm a little robot, and I'm going to start here. Okay. So the way that I'll say it is I'll say I walk, I rotate, and then I walk. Okay. So let's see what I do. I start here, I walk, I come to an intersection, okay? I'm fed in a 2. Okay? I can't see the bulk, but like pretend I'm just fed the string. So I'm allowed to see the 2. I see a 2 and I say, "Okay, there's 1, 2." Okay, so I walk along the 2. I come here. I could go this way or I could go this way, but I am fed a 1 in my string, so I walk here. Does it make sense? Yeah. And then you could obviously ask, "Oh, what if I started at a different spot, or, you know, how do I know to count from the left to the right?" I mean, it doesn't matter. They're going to be related by reflections or rotations, or, right? So up to all that kind of stuff, you're going to recreate the boundary or the bulk. Just one other thing is this also gives meaning to what I meant by there was these things that I said were like negative numbers that showed up. They never actually show up in these strings, but if you wanted to give a geometric interpretation to these negative numbers, I mean, it's just the exact same thing, but you're now, instead of walking forward, rotating, and then walking, you're gonna turn around, walk, rotate, and walk. And that's what the negative number interprets as. And it's actually very nice because it makes a whole bunch of other parts of the story essentially unique. I won't go into the details, but yeah. Another?
Explain more like why your new tiling is different from the promise tiling.
Yeah. So, here's a little bit of a cheating answer. Here's one reason it can't be. Penrose tiling doesn't have a point of threefold symmetry, right?
Uh-huh.
But the if you grow from an icosahedron, icosahedra have points of threefold symmetry, and you would expect there's at least one tiling in this new class that has points of threefold symmetry, because there's at least one tiling that can be grown from a single icosahedron.
Is there a three-fold symmetry
in the icosahedron?
Look.
There are points of threefold symmetry in icosahedron, so the boundary, so the tiling should have it as well. If you grow from a very symmetric configuration like the icosahedron,
but you can never see it from local rows.
Yeah, and in fact, both of our proofs, our other proof also relies on having, yeah, it's globally distinguished, is how we distinguish it based on global properties. So yeah.
So this is problem of the global, like, space.
Yes.
Sorry, I would say it differently than in response to Joe's question. Locally, if you take a locally five-fold symmetric patch in the Penrose tiling, the inflation rule, if you inflate it, it takes... the inflation of a little locally five-fold symmetric patch gives you another five-fold symmetric patch, and you need to inflate four times to get back to the original patch in the original configuration, it turns out, because there's sort of two types of patches, an A and B patch, and then each of them can be rotated by 180 degrees to give a total of four different patches, and you cycle through all four of those. Whereas our inflation rules, you get back to the original patch after only two inflations, so that's a local way to see that it's not the same as the Penrose tile.
But then what if you do this Penrose inflation twice? Like you regard it twice as one unit, then can I say that you got the square lambda, square factor?
So yeah, but you can't, it still doesn't work because there's a certain rescaling. There's a certain, you know, number that by which the tiling rescales after an inflation, and those would have to match too. So if, you know, the normal Penrose tiling rescales by a factor of the golden ratio after one inflation, our tiling actually rescales by a factor of the golden ratio squared. So it would have to be one of our inflations should be, if there's a matchup, it should be like two inflations of the Penrose tiling, but instead it doesn't work in that sense, that after one of our inflations, which is like two Penrose tiling inflations, we're already back to the original configuration locally, whereas Penrose tiling would take, if there was a match, it would have had to take two inflations of our tiling.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Mark, a question? You're starting with these very regular tilings of the volume space, but I mean, can it work more generally? Particular, what if I start with something aperiodic?
An aperiodic tiling of hyperbolic space? I don't know if there's actually a definition of, yeah. There's not really a good definition of aperiodic tiling.
Is it because there can't be, like there's some reason, there's some theorem that there can't be, or just that it's...
No, I think some people have tried, like I think Chaim Goodman Strauss has tried and things like this, but I'm not 100% sure. In fact, part of our claim would be that, you know, maybe this is the right way to think about hyperbolic or quasi-periodic patterns in hyperbolic space, but okay.
Just to add one thing, sorry to keep jumping in here, but you could say that our tilings are aperiodic in the sense that you can show that there's no So we have some sort of, you know, our tiling is some sort of ripply surface in 2D surface in 3D hyperbolic space. And there's no, the analog of there being no translational symmetry is that there's no isometry, no non-trivial isometry in 3D hyperbolic space that carries that 2D ripply surface into itself completely. Like the analog of saying there's no translations that carry the Penrose pattern into itself.
Be the final say, Justin.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Great. Thanks for coming.